이렇게 최첸 있는 모습을 사람들은 좋습니다. So, there any questions on the topic we are looking at, refuge, from previous sessions? Any comment? We've been looking at this whole topic of going for refuge, which is kind of the term that we Buddhists use, you know, for becoming a Buddhist. A Buddhist is someone that go for refuge to the what we call the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Yeah. So that is our sort of trademark, been identified as a Buddhist. Yeah. So any one of you, for just a show of hand, have gone through the like a former refuge ceremony to become a Buddhist? Anybody? Well, there's a lot of people who hold the idea of being a Buddhist. Yeah. So strictly speaking, you don't need to go through a ceremony, though a lot of us we opt to go through it. Yeah, because refuge is a kind of a inner thing. You sort of in your mind, your heart, you make up your mind to go for refuge. Yeah. But quite often in our conventional world, we like to go through a ceremony, a bit like the baptism of Christianity. You know, you've been baptized, and so likewise we with this we go through a refuge ceremony. You know, usually with a Buddhist teacher. Or sometimes we call it a preceptor, you know, to preside over the ceremony, and then after that we felt like, oh, I've been reborn as a Buddhist, yeah. So it can be quite emotional. I think all I remember of my refuge ceremony is because I was kneeling there, I thought, oh, when is this going to be over? It really hurt a lot to be kneeling there, but and also I don't know the procedure. Wherever Sangha Kadro, my preceptor. And she gave the refuge ceremony. And then out of the blue, she said, oh, we'll do a prostration to the 35 Buddhas to start off with. So I said, oh, wow, it's so strenuous. I just prostrate at least 35 times before I can become a Buddhist. I should be warned, you know, that there's such requirement. But nonetheless, having gone through a ceremony, it's all firm up in our mind. Certain kind of commitment, certain decision we made to follow the Buddhist teaching, to follow the Buddhist path. Yeah. So, in this series, which I call Experiencing the Buddhist Teaching, so we want to look at not just on the idea of refuge, but I also would like to talk about and we can explore a bit, how can we actually experience the sense of refuge in ourselves. And that's what I mean by experiencing Buddhist teaching. Not only do we learn about the object of refuge in Buddhism, how can we actually experience, you know, this act of going for refuge? And if we do have it, how can we deepen that, the sense of trust, the sense of reliance, yeah, in our day-to-day life? Usually when things are going well, we are pretty good Buddhists. You know, we remember, we recite the refuge formula, and we do all the right things. So when things are not going well, then at difficult times or at very stressful times, or you find that you are very stretched a lot, or you have very little resources, inner resources, then those are critical moments where either we fall back and rely on so-called refuge, or more likely than not, we find that we rely on our old habits of which just sort of arise spontaneously, you know, which we rely on to deal with stressful times, difficult times. And so it is actually a difficult moment that we are tested, so to speak, and whether our refuge is of is authentic or not, or whether really, you know, really able to serve its function, to to support us and to protect us. Or maybe it's the first thing we forgot about it. Because, oh yeah, there's such a thing called Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha that I proclaim to rely on. All I remember is my potato chips, you know, and my, whatever, YouTube videos, you know, that I just so stressed and I cannot do other things. That's all I remember. That's what I mean by when you fall back on old habits, very familiar habits that we rely on to deal with distressing emotions or difficult situations. And those are the times when you can get a good sense of how strong is your so-called refuge. Right, and that's what we're going to look at. Right, so to start, so far I have covered at least what I remembered. Sometimes actually I don't remember what I said. I just have a rough idea. But I think I covered right at the beginning the two causes of refuge. What are the conditions or causes that allow people or enable them to go for refuge? One of them, according to the teaching, is our fear and dislike of suffering and the causes of suffering. We don't want to suffer, which is why we look for what can help me, what can protect me from not only suffering but the causes of suffering. So that is one of the so-called causes, refuge. And the second one is a sense of trust or confidence in the objects of refuge, that they are able to protect me, that they are genuine and they have the power or the ability to help me. So, and as I mentioned in the Buddhist context, then these objects of refuge are the Buddha, the enlightened one, the Dharma, his teaching, and the Sangha, the community of fellow practitioners. Yeah. So those are the two causes. One is fear, but sometimes fear is probably too strong a word. Because in a sense, it's not like we live constantly in fear. No. But it's more like our genuine, we don't want to suffer. And we don't want to suffer, and we don't want the causes of suffering. So that is one of the causes, and the other one, of course, is sometimes people translate as faith. I prefer the word trust. Our trust in the object of refuge. Our confidence in their ability. So these are the kind of two qualities of mind or heart that that at the basis of going for refuge. So that's what I covered. And then I kind of start to introduce these three objects of refuge. I talk about the Buddha Jewel, the Buddha, the awakened one, the enlightened one, which can refer, quite often refer to a specific person, the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. But we can also generalize it because he's not the only one that has attained the state of enlightenment. There are also many others before him and after him. That's how Buddhism works. We don't really usually, I think all the traditions of Buddhism accept that there are more than one Buddha. Just maybe there are some variations in how they look at it, but there are more than one person has and can achieve this state of enlightenment, complete freedom from suffering and the causes of suffering. So there's the Buddha. Then we also look at the Dharma, which is the teaching, which also sometimes also interpret as the truth or reality that the Buddha discovers and subsequently show to us or explain to us. And if you remember, I talk about two types of teaching. One is called scriptural teaching. That's when we learn and we acquire the information, the knowledge, like come to a class like this, or we read a book, or we listen to some podcast, and so on and so forth. So we acquire information and knowledge that hopefully are valid and about reality that help us better able to deal with suffering and the cause of suffering. So that is called scriptural dharma, scriptural teaching. So it's sort of more on remain on the intellectual level. Then another type of dharma jewel, another aspect of it is what we call realizational dharma. This is not just intellectual knowledge, it is actual transformation within ourselves, within our mind, actual changes to our habit, you know, and we acquire certain realization, we make real the Buddha's teaching in our own life, in our own experience. So this is like the real thing, because this is the one, once you realize something, you gain a realization, you also gain a real actual protection from some of the suffering or some of the causes of suffering. You have succeed to abandon some of the causes of your suffering. So you're free from that. So this is the real deal, the realization. Yeah. So this is what I have covered so far on the object of refuge. So today, to round it up, I want to talk a little bit about the third one, the Sangha jewel. Sangha has the meaning of an assembly or a gathering. And again, known like the other, you can understand Sangha at two different levels. The more conventional one, the word Sangha, especially I think in Southeast Asia, we tend to use the word Sangha to refer only to the monastic community, the monks and the nuns. Yeah. In the West, they tend to use the word Sangha to refer to a much broader kind of life. Just in the West, no, not so many monastics. So more, in fact, in countries like America or Australia or in Europe, you'll find a lot of Buddhist communities are made up of entirely lay people, very few monastics. Yeah. So it's understandable why quite often you find that in books written in English and other European languages, the word Sangha tends to refer to not only to the monastic community, but includes the fellow practitioners, fellow lay Buddhists. And that is technically not incorrect, because the Buddha accepts that among his followers, he accepts what he calls the fourfold community, four groups of followers. The bhikshu, the Sanskrit bhikshu means the monks, and the bhikshuni, the nuns. This includes both the novices and the fully ordained monks and nuns. He also accepts two other communities, the laymen, lay Buddhist men, and the women. So he sometimes refers to his followers, those people who follow his teaching. He refers to these four communities, these four groups of people, you know, both the monastic and the lay. And in fact, it has to be together, because the way the Buddha set up his monastic community, especially in the early days while he was alive, the monastic community is very much dependent on the lay community to support them. So they are in a kind of mutual dependent kind of relationship. Especially the lay community provide the material support, you know, to support the monastics in their practice and study, and the monastics provide the spiritual guidance for the lay people. So it's a mutually beneficial and dependent relationship. So it's good to not chop it up into half. So on a conventional level, when we talk about the Sangha jewel, you know, we can talk about relying on the community of fellow practitioners, that we can rely on them, you know, in many ways. Yeah. So, and I'd like to include both the monastics and the lay people. And having like-minded companions on one's spiritual journey is actually a very important thing. Well, unless you are very reclusive, or you decided you're going to spend the rest of your life in the cave somewhere. I don't know whether you can find a cave in Singapore. Yeah. You might have to travel a bit and make sure you get your visa. Yeah. So life is a bit complicated these days, but if we live in a society, or at least we know we have interaction with others, we need a community around us. And often on this topic, I talk about not so much that we join a community, but we must build our own community. Join is like, you know, like ABC here, then you go and get a membership form and you fill out. I said something wrong. What happened? Right. Anyway. Then we join a community, right? That's how most people think of joining, you know, become a member, and then you have to attend AGM, and then to vote, or attend your proxy form, and all this kind of stuff. usually the community always worry, oh, not enough people turn up, no, maybe the AGM is not valid and stuff like that. Yeah. But those are administrative things. But reality, a community, our own community, the community of people, you know, that were, that we interact with, that we have, that provide us the support that we need, and also we provide them with support. I think we need to build it. We need to build it from scratch, right? It's not like you just join and then you have a card or you are members and then voila, you have a community. You will be very disappointed, you know, with this kind of community, because at times of need, they're nowhere to be found, you know? What happened to the community? They're all very busy with their life. Right? Yeah. Whereas, what is needed is we need to build our own community, you know, even though maybe it's within an organization or whatever. We still need to, the community is built by interaction, getting to know one another, getting to be able to support one another. And that's how we start to assemble our own community. And our community of like-minded people are able to exert a positive influence. They can be our strength, they can be our, they can give us advice, can point out our mistakes, you know, and they give us both spiritual, emotional support, and sometimes even material support. Yeah. So the community is very important in the spiritual sense, of course, also in a very kind of mundane, worldly sense. We also need a kind of social connection and social support for our own well-being. So we build our conventional community. Right? In fact, the Buddha said that it's very important to keep good company. Keep good company with the wise one. Don't keep close company with fools. No, the foolish one. Foolish ones are basically like, or childish ones. That's another term that in Buddhism we use. These are people who, maybe you get along well with them, but they exert a negative influence on you. They may keep you trapped within, your old habits. You know, they may strengthen your delusion as opposed to your wisdom. They strengthen your greed as opposed to your renunciation. Or they strengthen your hatred as opposed to your kindness. Hatred is very easy to strengthen. Right? You just, like in the office situation, you just, you know, you don't like somebody, so you talk to this other colleague, you badmouth the person. You want them to support you, right? To join in. You know? So we all should gather together all the scandals and bad things about the one person that you all don't like. So you are assembled, you are gathered on the basis of dislike and hatred. And this kind of gathering tends to increase those negative emotions. Right? The more you talk about it, the more other people agree with you, the stronger will be those feelings of anger or hatred or whatever. And this is what the Buddha advised us not to do. Okay? In the event that you cannot find like-minded company, you're surrounded by fools, it's better to proceed on your own. As like a rhinoceros. That's one discourse that the Buddha gave. You know, at times like this, some of those companies can exert a very bad influence on you, and they can deviate you from your choice, your aspiration. So, Buddhism, the Buddha placed great emphasis on who are those people that we surround ourselves with, and to be aware of their influences, good or bad. Okay, so on a conventional level, that's the Sangha Jewel. People around us that show the same interest, in this case the study of the Buddha's teaching, the practice of the Buddha's teaching, and we are able to mutually support one another in our pursuit, in our goal. But there is also another level or to Sangha, and sometimes this is called the noble Sangha or Arya Sangha in Sanskrit. And in this case, it can refer to just a single individual. It can be a lot, but usually just one. They're not so readily available. A noble Sangha is a person who has realized the Buddha's teaching, who has actualized the Buddha's teaching in their heart and mind, And so it becomes what we call a noble one. So this is not just having studied, but someone who has realized the teaching. In fact, in the different ways of describing the stages towards enlightenment, you know, quite often this very first stage of directly realizing the truth or reality or emptiness, sometimes this person is called the stream enterer, especially in the Theravada tradition. So this is a noble person, has actualized and realized the truth of the teaching directly. And something fundamental has changed in this person's mind and heart. Make this person a bit different from the rest of us. Right? So this is the noble Sangha. And if you have the good fortune to encounter such a person, then one person is good enough as a Sangha jewel to rely on. Because this person has an actual realization. And when you keep company with such a person, they will be able to help you also to realize the teaching in yourself directly. Okay. So that we can put at these two levels. The conventional sanghas are just like-minded people, you know, all interested in the Buddhist teaching or doing our best to learn and practice the Buddhist teaching. But we may or may not have any realization. We may be just as deluded as you are. No? Just that we all, at least we have good aspiration. But doesn't necessarily mean that what we understood, what we are practicing, are necessarily the most accurate. Okay, but a noble sangha is different. A noble sangha is someone who has actualized the teaching, who has directly realized the truth of what the Buddha has been talking about. Almost like he has a glimpse of what the Buddha realized. He or she has an actual glimpse, and that glimpse has fundamentally changed his perspective. So this person is called a stream enterer. It's a technical word. Stream enterer means this person has entered into a stream of water. Right? And this water or river only flows in one direction. It flows towards enlightenment or nirvana, the goal of Buddhism. So it's almost like someone who has entered this stream will eventually almost confirm will arrive at the goal of enlightenment. It's just a matter of time, you know, sooner or later, but he or she will definitely achieve enlightenment. Okay. But there's a, even tradition has different ways, you know. The most common one is within 7 lifetimes, this person will achieve enlightenment. Okay. So such a person, a noble sangha, is very rare, right? Not so common. And also they don't come with a name tag. I'm a noble sangha. Right? In fact, if you see one, you better don't believe it. Okay. So, and interacting with this person, building a kind of spiritual friendship with this person can be very helpful. This is someone who has actually realized the teaching. Okay, so this is the Sangha. So if we look at the three of them, the three jewels together, there are different ways of presenting them. One way is to say the Buddha is the teacher of refuge. Because the Buddha realized and then taught the Buddha, not the teaching. No, so he's the teacher. The Dharma is the actual refuge. Because the Dharma, the teaching, when you realize it, this is the one that really protects us from suffering and the causes of suffering. So that is the actual refuge. And the Sangha are the helper or the supporter of refuge. They help us to learn about the refuge, about Dharma. They help us to practice it. They help us to actualize it. So that is the teacher of refuge, that is the actual refuge, and they are the helpers or supporters refuge. And so there's one way of looking at these three jewels. So far, okay. But I did mention earlier on that, but among the three, different people are drawn to different jewels. You know? Maybe their relationship with one of them is particularly strong. And so there are different ways to come to refuge. Not everyone, do it in the same way. Some people are very much, like I'm very much attracted to the Dharma. I came to Buddhism because of the teaching. I find the teaching so marvelous, provides such a clear framework to understand, you know. Back then I was looking for a framework to understand meditation. And I think that Buddhist explanation is superb, so clear, so reasonable, you know. And I have always felt like that. So for me, the Dharma is the one that attracted me. And via that, then, that's how I understand the Buddha and the Sangha. Other people are different. Other people may come to the Buddhism because of the encounter with a Sangha member, a Buddhist, maybe a monastic or lay people, and through them, you know, they come into touch with the Buddhism, with Buddha's teaching, and they benefited from it. So they come to refuge via, I think, the Sangha. Then there are other people that come to refuge to Buddhism via quite often like meeting a spiritual teacher, which is almost like especially in Tibetan Buddhism, we talk about, actually not in the tradition, but people always refer to them as living Buddha, you know, the reincarnated Lama, you know, very special people with wonderful qualities, and to encounter with one such person, then they are drawn to the Dharma, you know, and they start to practice it, and also that is how they enter into, that's where they place their trust, to find refuge. So that's what, therefore there are different avenues where we come to find refuge, we come to develop the trust, come to learn about the Dharma and put it into practice. Okay? So and it's good to keep that in mind, so, you know, we are all different, so you may find that different Buddhists relate to the three jewels in a different way. Yeah. Okay. But that is not so. The important thing is for each one of us to find within ourselves that sense of trust and confidence, you know, in the objects of, in our objects of refuge, and to be able to rely on them. Okay. So with that, I kind of conclude my introduction of this three objects of refuge in Buddhism. So is there any question or comment? I hope you know, even if you're Buddhist, I hope you know what you're taking refuge in, right? Like, oh, not so sure that. Don't know lah. I just recite. No. They asked me to recite, then I recite on this, like that. So it's good to have some idea, and you don't have to, you know, follow what I say, but your own understanding of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the three jewels. An arahant. How to identify an arahant? An arahant is someone who follows the Buddha's teaching and attains enlightenment. How to identify? Very difficult. Definitely don't trust the person that tell you my title is arahant. Arahant Wai Chong. You should not trust. Okay. I think it's really difficult externally to gauge precisely an individual's spiritual realizations and spiritual attainment. And sometimes I think maybe it's best not necessary. You know, of course, it would be nice if there is a kind of objective system where you just send them through it and then they come with, you know, come up with a tag and say half an arahant, three quarter of an arahant, or fully arahant, you know, or Buddha, you know. Then you say, and this is certified, you know, stamped with the right signature, and they say, oh, this is trustworthy. They just have to renew their membership every year, and then you can, you know, they are trustworthy, they are certified. Yeah. But unfortunately, there's no such way to do it. So I think instead of struggling to say, oh, you know, this person, I want to take this person to be a teacher, you know, but I'm not sure whether it's arahant or not, whether it's a Buddha. I think a more reliable way, as you explain the teaching, is to not worry so much about, we wonder what is going on. The universe is not very happy with me. It's down. Instead of trying to fix their so-called level of spiritual attainment, in the teaching says that instead of doing that, try to instead focus on the good qualities you can see or you can come to know about the person. You focus on their good qualities. Right? So you can see that, oh, such a person is very wise, very kind, very patient, really very selfless, really very compassionate. you can see through their behavior, through the interaction with you and others, you know, and you try to highlight those good qualities that when you think about it, maybe you feel a kind of admiration, or when you remember your interaction with them, you found that it has been so beneficial and helpful and supportive, you know, and that is the basis for developing confidence in this person, especially if it's like a kind of a spiritual friend or a teacher, and you have a kind of relationship, you know, interpersonal relationship with this person. Any other relationship, as we start to see the good qualities of this person, then we come to trust this person more and more. And I think that is the best way to do it, isn't it? Because all those labels that we put on people, you know, eventually, you know, sometimes we are unfortunate, you know, you might find that the person is... It's very, very strange. Yeah. The person did something that kind of contradict your idea of what he or she should or should not do, right? Contradict the idea of your image of that labor. Then you say, oh, I'm very disappointed with you. So, that's the problem with labeling. The labor is, we stick the labor on the person, right? And then later we get upset that it's the wrong label. Then we blame the person. You didn't live up to my labeling system. No, you disturbed my worldview. Okay? But then the person said, I never say, I'm that label, right? But you decided on it. Much better to, you know, really see the person in a very more kind of complete way, that they are good qualities, but they are also, maybe they are aspects of the person that you find difficult to deal with, or they press your button. So, but when you weigh out the good and bad, you can, then you can see, well, no. That's why the teaching says, focus on the good qualities and ignore the flaws. Because if you were to, focus a lot on the flaws, of course you come to dislike this person, you find that this person has disappointed you, and so on. So I think, also from my own personal experience, labeling can be quite dangerous thing to do, whereas focusing on actual qualities that we see and we can identify in the person, really foster that relationship. Help, please identify the source of disturbance. Okay, so that brings me to the topic of spiritual teacher, a spiritual teacher or a Buddhist teacher. Sometimes, especially in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, come to be seen as the embodiment of the three objects of refuge. The spiritual teacher takes the place of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. All three combined into one person. Of course, you can have more than one teacher, but in this tradition, the spiritual teacher plays a very important role in our Buddhist path, in our Buddhist journey. And we are taught to really see our teachers, those people that we come to regard as our teachers, see them as embodying all three objects of refuge. And in a way you can understand, just the historical Buddha is no longer physically with us, his physical presence is dissolved. Right? So who among our, in our life, come closest to Buddha? That can sort of represent him or take his place or actually be the Buddha. Quite often, it's our spiritual teacher, someone that we admire, someone we see, he or she has such wonderful qualities. And then, also it's through the spiritual teacher that we receive teaching. The Dharma came from him or her. And also, at times of difficulty, good times, bad times, who do we rely on for advice? Or, you go back to spiritual teacher. So that one single person, in a way, embodies the three roles played by the three gurus. So that's why, especially in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, so often you find that on top of the three usual refuges, like I go for refuge to Buddha, the Dharma is Sangha, and another line, that I go for refuge to the spiritual teacher, or guru, Sanskrit, or lama. Okay, so, other Buddhist traditions, they don't explicitly say that. But nonetheless, Buddhist teachers always hold a very special role in Buddhism, even though they may not explicitly identify Buddhist teachers as Buddha, the Dharma, and Sangha. But nonetheless, you know, it's always been held in high regard in Buddhism. Okay. So that's why the relationship with our spiritual teachers, especially in the Tibetan Buddhist context, is a very important relationship. It's also a very powerful relationship, because you have a really wonderful positive relationship with a qualified teacher. It really allow you to see the benefit of refuge, of how by relying on a teacher, it's like relying on the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and you can really see in yourself the benefit of it. And that reaffirms our confidence and helps to stabilize our refuge. Okay. What is the dangerous thing that this relationship with a spiritual teacher? It's like any other interpersonal relationship. Actually in Tibetan, there's a wonderful image they give to illustrate this relationship with a teacher. They say a teacher is like a fire. This is Tibet, okay? Like a fire. If you stand too far away from it, you don't benefit from the warmth or the heat, right? You're still cold, right? But if you stand too close to the fire, you'll be burned by it, right? So that is an image of the hazard that involved in interacting in our relationship with spiritual teacher. You know, it's no point having a spiritual teacher and then don't interact with him or her and stand very, very far away. So there's no benefit to come from that so-called relationship. On the other hand, if you try too hard to be very close to the teacher, then there's a great chance that you might be disappointed in your close encounter with the spiritual teacher. I've been burned, in many different ways. So this image comes from long experience, the wisdom that passed down from many generations. So the teacher is someone that you interact with, with great respect and also with great care. Because it's a kind of any other human relationship. You need to enter into it with wisdom. Okay. And in my 30 years of interaction with in Tibetan Buddhist circle, it is very true. I've seen people benefited from the relationship, I've been to the birth by that relationship, and it can be very, very messy, including even my own experience. But it's really a very powerful illustration of reliance on refuge. Because when we do our best to nurture that relationship with a qualified teacher, I can really say that has really benefited me, and it's also where we learn the most. And these are knowledge and understanding that is very personal, very direct. Whereas you learn from a book is very generic, very generalized. In your interaction with the teacher, you really can benefit from it. Not just consciously, but also unconsciously. So I share a few examples. I studied in Italy for 7 years under the master program for Buddhist philosophy, under this organization, FPMT, Foundation for Preservation of Mahayana Tradition. Always say it's a mouthful to talk about the title of this organization. But I studied 7 years with my teacher, Geshe Jabba Gyatso. It's a very interesting relationship. I was never really close to him. I have other classmates who are really, really close to him. I have my roommate, has a very different relationship with, we have the same teacher, but very different relationship. I just illustrate a bit. My roommate, every summer, we have, I can't remember, maybe 2 months break, and
So he will go and ask our teacher and say, oh, Vishnu, what should I do over the summer break? Vishnu will give him almost like a checklist. First week you go home, spend time with your parents, you do this, you do that. Second week you do this, third week you do that, then you come back here, and you do this practice, and you meditate on this, and blah, blah, blah. Down through that. Really like a checklist, right? And then, and he is that sort of person that is his great devotion, not like me. So he will actually follow it to the letter. And me, I don't leave things to chance. So I plan my 2 month holiday already. I plan everything. I'll go here, I'll do this, I'll do that. And then, since everybody around me all go and ask Vishala about the summer plan, then I say it like this. I suppose I should just show up and say, oh, Vishala, what should I do for summer? Having already planned everything, right? Even buy the ticket already. Then Geshe-la always said, oh, you choose. And then ciao, and disappear. And that's it, right? That's usually my conversation. It's counted in seconds. Not minutes, but just seconds. Then, oh, alright, didn't you say I choose? So I choose. So I did it for 2 years. Same answer. You choose. And after that, I stopped doing it. Because it's a bit hypocritical, right? I don't really want him to tell me what to do. So, that's not. But this illustrates how he treats us differently. And so, even though we share a teacher, we actually have a very different relationship with him. And I always said that he's very skillful in this. I don't know how he managed to figure that out. Maybe it's all written on my face. Don't tell me anything. I already planned my holiday. But I find that quite, I always admire him for that. That he's not just dosing up advice, like standard advice, people print all those standard advice, right? When you ask, you pull out and say, It is. Individual students, he relates to them individually. But I think he did it intuitively. He didn't kind of like, tell me, just came from him. So, that was very, I admire him for his ability to adapt and to relate to each one of us as individuals. I have quite a lot of stories of him. And another story of him, which I also admire him very much for, is the first year of the program was really difficult. You know, because the program is entirely new. We're kind of like guinea pigs, with all put together, and there are a lot of experimental things. It was very frustrating because there's no text. No one has translated those texts. So we don't have actual English translation to rely on. All we have is what comes out of the mouth of our translator and interpreter. And our translator and interpreter is a source of great anguish for me and others. He would do something like this. He would say, he has many different things. He would say, oh, it's enough for you today. No, that's enough information for today. You should be satisfied. And then Geshe would say, no, you shouldn't be. No, you should not be easily satisfied with your study, but be easily satisfied with your material things. Anyway, our translator caused me a lot of anguish. So I'm always very upset, very frustrated at the first part of the course. Because so many of us gave up so much. We give our career, we move all the way there, we want to be able to really study the Dharma. So I went to talk to Geshe-la and basically complained. Then he always said, oh, relax, ciao. That's it. Yeah, a few second consultation with my teacher. So for the first maybe 9 months of the year, every time when I go and see him, I will get the same advice that really irritated me more. I really hated that advice. Yeah. Because I keep telling myself, I think I'm quite relaxed already, right? If I were to relax some more, I'll be doing nothing. Achieve nothing. I was just really tense and wound down. And then maybe towards the last part of the year, maybe something changed in me. I finally thought, I think I gave up. I just gave up trying. Or whatever. I understand. If I don't understand, I don't understand. I just forget about it. So I actually relax. And I feel much better. I'm much happier. So I just study whatever I can. I read whatever I can. And I really enjoy, I start to enjoy the course. And you know what the miraculous thing is? My teacher, Krishna, stopped asking me to relax. And for the rest of that 7 years, he never gave me that same advice again. No? He actually stopped saying the word relax. How could he figure that out? How do we know? I don't know. But that was a good lesson for me. So now I talk to you, I remember all the little interaction I had with my teacher. And although I always tell people I'm not close to my teacher, which is true, I'm not close in any way. But many years later, when I was teaching full time in Sydney, teaching Buddhism and meditation, I think I noticed something has changed in me. Geshe-la, my teacher, used to teach us Monday to Friday, one or two lessons a day. This is not short lesson, like 2 hours, morning and afternoon. So you can accumulate like 4 hours teaching a day. Teach us from Monday to Friday. Friday only morning, and then he has lunch, and then he would hop into a car, someone would drive him to a train station, he would go off to one of a Buddhist center. There are many centers in Italy affiliated to FDMC. Then he will go there to teach over the weekend, Saturday, Sunday, and both days. And then on Monday morning, he would hop into a car. Someone there would drive him, take a train, arrive back in the institute, called Instituto Lama Tsongkhapa, that's the center I study, have lunch, and then come to teach us, afternoon, Monday afternoon. So he will do this throughout the month, basically. Basically, it's almost teaching every day. He will have probably 1 weekend free in the month for himself. He will just go on like this for the entire year. He probably will claim like 1 or 2 weeks of holiday for himself. That's when he did his own personal retreat. He liked to live on his own. He just, no attendant, nothing. Just leave me alone. Someone gave him rent, stay in a house. And they've got the grocery list, whatever. And then he just happily by himself doing his own practice. That's it. So he's been doing it for 7 years. In fact, even towards the end, he was diagnosed with a tumor in his lung. He still refused. I think he cut back a bit, but he still prefers to teach. So that's his behavior. And subsequently, when I was in Sydney, I started to look at him as an example, as a model. So then this kind of like, teach one evening, weekday, and what I'm doing now, like one evening, week Tuesday and then Saturday morning, my teacher standard is like something like that. I'm doing almost nothing, right? You call that teaching? You know, it's like just having a holiday, right? You know, you just dip your toe in a bit. So when I was in Sydney, I find myself that I'm quite happy to teach. I can teach from Monday to Friday all the evening. I used to travel to other parts of New South Wales. I'll travel by train and teach a weekend course. And come back and start again. That's the norm. That's what my teacher did. Of course, I'm not at this caliber. Eventually, I'm a little bit burnt out. I need to give back my teaching schedule. But I was very happy to see it in myself. I said, oh, I'm not so bad. Something from my teacher has kind of rubbed off on me unconsciously. And that I have somehow adopted, his behavior, his standard for myself. And I see that as something to aspire to. And that is something really what we all can do, at least for myself. And so, I mention all these stories to show that sometimes our interaction with our so-called Buddhist teacher may not be what most people will consider a very close relationship. I'm not his friend. I don't know what he does. I don't go and talk to him. Anyway, he doesn't give me much time in those few seconds. What can you say in a few seconds, right? Isn't it? But nonetheless, if I look back, I find that that relationship has really benefited me, in many ways. Some ways I'm consciously aware of, others are more like subconscious or unconscious. But I have to say, after all these years, now he has passed on, now he has been really a very positive kind of interaction. And I really wish each one of us has our own fortune to have some kind of interaction in that way. Because it really kind of, it really brings to mind what it means by refuge, that you have you come to find within yourself that, oh, there's something that I can really entrust and I can rely on. And in turn, I really have the confidence that it's really able to support me, really help me. So that is the whole idea behind refuge, going for refuge. In this case, going for refuge to one's spiritual teacher. So these are what we call outer refuge. The Buddha, our spiritual teacher, the Dharma in the form of text, or videos, or whatever, Sangha in the sense of other people around us. These are outer refuge. They somehow are outside of me. But we also talk about inner refuge, the refuge that we can find within ourselves. It's almost as if, actually within myself, within yourself, we also have inner Buddha jewel, inner Dharma jewel, and inner Sangha jewel. How amazing! It's sort of like come packaged with you. You can bring it with you anywhere. So what are these inner refuge, inner objective refuge? It's, in a way, it's quite simple. Sometimes people talk about our inner Buddha nature, our Buddha potential. Each one of us actually has within ourselves the potential to become a Buddha, to be enlightened, to gain those realizations, to actually become a Sangha, a noble Sangha, to be a Buddha. Each one of us, we have that potential to realize the Dharma. So we actually have the realization, and therefore we become a noble Sangha. And then eventually we may actually become a Buddha or an Arahant. So this is the inner refuge. This is something that we can find within ourselves. So maybe at this moment it may exist as a potential, as a possibility, but sometime in the future it can be actualized and become something real. And when you have it, not only are you your own refuge, but you actually become an object of refuge of other people. When you become a Buddha, an Arahant, when you gain actual realization, you become an overcomer. Then you, not only are you an object of refuge for yourself, that you are able to protect yourself from suffering, causes of suffering, but you actually can be a refuge for other people. How wonderful that is. But unfortunately, quite often we don't believe in the inner refuge. Sometimes we kind of undermine ourselves. We undermine that sense of self-confidence. We say, oh, not this life. I really hate that. So, not this life, when? No. I cannot do it in this life. I have to wait until the next life. And then the next life will be like this life, isn't it? You have this habit of saying the next life. Then most probably the next life, you'll say the next life, right? Which means it will never happen. Now that you have a precious human life, precious human river, if not now, when? So, and I think sometimes when we say that, it comes from a lack of confidence that actually we ourselves can actualize the future. We can have a realization. We can actually become a noble Sangha, or we can become a Buddha. I know it sounds very modest to say, I don't know anything. I don't realize anything. I can't do it. It sounds modest, but I call it false modesty. Okay? False modesty because, well, there's nothing there to be modest about. What's there? You say you don't have anything, what's there to be modest about, right? Is when you have some high achievement, then you, okay. You don't be proud, don't be arrogant, right? If you think that you are like, right at the bottom, what's there to be modest about? You're already at the bottom. So that I don't think is what humility is all about. Modesty is not about that. That is actually maybe undermining yourself, putting yourself down. But I think it's important to develop a more positive view of ourselves and our potential. That, you know, our refuge is not only outside of us, but we actually can find it within ourselves. We really, you know, we can aspire to find that refuge within us. Aspire to realize at least some of the teachings, make real of it, so that we can be happier, and be free of suffering and the cause of suffering. And we can also be of benefit to others, we can be of that refuge for others. The Sangha is known, Sangha is a person, right? So when you have the actual realization Dharma, then you become Sangha, a noble Sangha. When you, if I say I realize the truth to be honest, I have a realization, I am selfless, then that very moment, I am also become a noble Sangha. Then of course if I bring it, take that path all the way to the end, I actually become a Buddha. So then, not only do I have a Buddha refuge outside, but I'm actually myself as a Buddha. I become the actual Buddha jewel. So the inner aspect can be on the potential level, can be on the actual level. Potential is we all have the Buddha nature, so we all can become a Buddha. We have the potential to realize the Dharma, the potential to become a noble Sangha. But we can also, one day, we will become those three things. And one day we have all the realization, the Dharma. We ourselves become noble Sangha, and we ourselves become the Buddha. So that is what, how we talk about inner refuge. But I think it's important to balance their outer refuge, and there is also inner refuge. So not only do we see the good qualities in those outside of us, around us, but we also need to recognize our own inner good qualities, our own inner potential. Okay. So the last part of this topic on refuge is then how do we come to rely on the refuge? How do we cultivate so that we actually have that confidence in our refuge, and that we actually make use of it, we actually rely on it. You know what I mean? Like what I started talking about how, and this is more common than, it may sound like I'm joking, but it's actually very common. Study Buddhism and Buddhism, you do this retreat and that thing, and then something really terrible happened to you. You know what happened? Out come the potato chip. Then you tell people, I cannot meditate, I cannot do my sadhana. You know what I mean? But you feel that, you find that you cannot sit, you cannot calm your mind, you cannot concentrate because the emotions and the turmoil are so strong. Therefore, comfort eating. I'm not the only one that do it, right? It sounds so strange. Maybe not you, you know the prepared, but maybe you know people that do this kind of thing. This kind of indulgence. Which is actually a way of managing very distracting, very unpleasant feelings and emotions and inner turmoil. To take our attention away from the suffering and unpleasantness. So we find that we kind of numbing the mind. The mind engaged on the other one of course is drinking alcohol and other things. So, when that happens, then you realize that, in spite of what we said, we don't really have refuge, isn't it? Because in times of great need, what do we rely on? We fall back on very old conditioning, very old habits. So, kind of, I mean, it's perfectly understandable, because I also do that, and I'm still doing it. It's only when I teach refuge that I remember refuge. Normally, I don't remember, I just remember my potato chip. But how then do we cultivate? In this series, how do we cultivate the sense of reliance, so that we actually rely on our object. Any thoughts about it? It's something to do with realization of emptiness and selflessness, which is a difficult topic. So I find that sometimes I think people to become aware of faith can help them to the thing, the opposite of selflessness or emptiness is when we become very caught up in the self, caught up with in my problem, my difficulty. How dare you do it to me? Why is this happening to me? Not when we are in that state, our thoughts are all about me, poor me, the victim, so terrible, I'm so depressed. In those states of mind, those thoughts, that's where it's a space. Because it's all, you're kind of sort of like submerged in all those thoughts, all those feelings, and very unpleasant. So, in those days, it's very hard to tell people to realize selflessness. That, oh, there isn't a me there, here, actually. It's too much to ask. But you can say, well, try to look for space. Create some space. At least, create some space between your current difficulty, who you are. So maybe you can see things a bit clearer. Or sometimes we say, don't take things too personally. Yeah. So that's where I come from. Last week, my meditation. But if you, in those states, you find that there's no space at all in your mind. The mind seems to be chock-a-block, full of all the thoughts, all the images, all the feelings. And they just kind of go round and round and round in the loop, right? Whereas when you can, in meditation, you notice space. Then you notice that actually there's a lot of space for many things to happen. Right? There can be thoughts, and there's sometimes sound, like the ventilator, the sound, there's bodily sensations, and even the thoughts and the feelings, they change, they come and go. So then, it's almost like you have more breathing space, you're not so constricted, not so kind of overwhelmed by those thoughts.
Yeah.
The tunnel vision, yeah. Yeah. But the first thing is when you do that kind of meditation, you notice your tunnel better. You notice what built your own tunnel. The tunnel is built with brick, right? This brick is a very special brick. We build our own tunnel, actually. Maybe that's from, you can say karma, or simply from our past conditioning. Some of the conditioning is actually from our family. Our family influence, our cultural influence, our own personality, the views and opinions we pick up along the way, and we build this tunnel. And sometimes some people, the brick may be, I'm a useless person. It's spiral around that theme. Okay? And of course, it varies, it changes, but the underlying idea is that. And then some people say, oh, I'll always be a failure. So, when you do the meditation on space, you notice clearer the kind of thought. You see, it is by thinking in that way that we construct our tunnel, and we trap ourselves inside those tunnels. And that is the beginning of stepping out of the tunnel. So how do we, too close means too close, not in the sense, nothing to do with physical distance. But too close is some people, they try too hard, you know, to be like, I want my guru to see me as their friend, you know, that they will think about me, you know, and then if I WhatsApp him, he will reply to me immediately, and then, he will remember me. Sometimes people say, oh, do you remember me? Too close is when you have in your mind certain idea of how that relationship should be, and you try very hard to make it happen. I don't know whether you can encounter this kind of example. But people want, someone like they want a very special relationship. They want to be a special person to their guru. And then the guru treat them like, not like disregard them, but they treat them as one, just evenly like any other people who come to teaching or come to seek advice. Then you feel very upset. You feel like, hey, why like this, how come you don't give me special treatment? How come you gave away my gift for you? I give you this gift, how can you, give it to that person, How can you do that to me? That's right. So the close has to do with your attachment, your projection, and your expectation. And that distorted the relationship. Yeah. And that's when you, in some very extreme cases, one moment this person is most devoted to this guru, the next moment, you'll be going around the street everywhere and tell them, that Lama is fake, don't believe in everything they say, like the worst enemy. And that is, maybe sometimes it's true, but quite often there is an emotional reaction that swings from extreme attachment to extreme hatred, like any other human relationship. And that's when, that's what we mean by too close, or you try too hard to be close. Does that make sense? Yeah, rather than your labor. Oh, you're supposed to be perfect. How come you're not as perfect as I want you to be? Maybe the so-called imperfection is a teaching for you. Yes, maybe.
So this spirit of reliance and reach. Maybe a teacher actually will be blessed with you.
How my teacher for? I don't think he's... For him, I think it's no big deal. No, you don't understand why. What's the big fuss about? Because we all go and we petition him. We say, "Oh, please cancel all your teaching. No, just rest." Then what's the point? Why should I cancel all my teaching? Then I'm most happy when I can teach. So he insists on teaching. He says, "What do you expect me to do? Just sit around the whole day just because I have a tumor in my lungs, then I'm supposed to..." But I don't think it actually negatively impacted him in any way. At least I didn't see him that way. Yeah. And he actually wanted to just carry on as normal. So I can't say how he practiced refuge in those situations. He didn't do any special rituals, he didn't go and liberate 1 million animals. Business as usual, as far as I know. I don't actually know how Geshe-la look at that situation. But he definitely didn't do anything extra in relation to that. In fact, the way he passed away is also quite interesting. So he was in hospital because they want to image the tumor. This much later, I've already left. And so they injected this chemical. It's actually a imaging. Yeah. But it has this known side effect that leads to kidney failure. Kidney cannot excrete the imaging chemical. That is the beginning of all organ failure. Yeah. So, very hospitalized, and dad was dying, and the night that he died, he suddenly he asked the student who stay with him. He asked the student to help him up to sit in the meditation posture, to put on his robe, and he died. He passed away sitting in a meditation posture. So clearly, even in that state, he's quite in control of his own dying process. So I presume that being diagnosed with a tumor, I only guess it's of no big deal in his mind. At least that's how I see it. Yeah. We didn't react too well though. We were all panicking and people are doing all sorts of strange things. No one is so-called secretary cancel all his external teaching. He was so mad. He was saying, what is this? Who asked you to cancel all my external teaching? He was quite pissed with it, I think, for that. And I think we probably behave very unwisely, which often might happen. You know, we feel that we know better. Here you are, my object of interest, but nonetheless, I know better than you what you should do with your life, and you should do this and that and not do that. You know what I mean? We kind of, I think we overstep the boundaries in our so-called attempt to save him. Okay. So, I think with regard to the topic of refuge, the most important thing is to ask ourselves, you know, how do we actually rely on our refuge? Or maybe we don't. Because it's an integral part of Buddhist practice, is to find in what way can the object of refuge become our refuge, become our true refuge, and that in time for need, we actually rely on that. Okay? And in each one of us will do it differently. So like, some of us may meditate, some of us may recall the teaching, some of us may advice from our teacher, some of us may pray, and so we can behave very differently, but there are many, many different ways of relying. I think it's important to acknowledge that. But how we do it, really depends on us. The important thing is that we do it, because otherwise what's the point having the object of refuge? You don't rely on them, right? The important thing is to find your own way whereby you remember and you come back and rely on them, and in a way that is effective, that actually help you. Okay? I'm not so concerned whether you stay Buddhist, but if you stay Buddhist, I hope that Buddhist objects of refuge actually become a refuge. Actually are able to support you in times of need, are able to give you strength, are able to console you in times of great distress. That is of some benefit, and I think that's what the Buddha wants. So I want to describe a visualization practice we will do together. That is a common way that people practice going for refuge. And so I describe it and then we do it together. So in especially in Tibetan Buddhist context, we engage a lot of our meditation practice involve visualization. And so this visualization to do with refuge, we visualize the Buddha Shakyamuni, in the space in front of us. Usually they say it's about 2 meters in front of you at the level of your forehead. So you visualize that in that space in front of you, this Buddha appears. It could be a Tibetan Buddha, a Chinese Buddha, a Thai Buddha, a Burmese Buddha, or your own Buddha, I don't know. Appear in whichever form. Actually, the more important thing is in the form that you relate to very strongly. Yeah. I don't like Buddha statues. I'm not heavily interested in it. Then one year, I went with my friend to Wu Tai Fan, who is full of temples all over the place. You sort of go from one temple to another. And there was, I can't remember, I think there was a temple honoring Manjushri, the huge statue, at least 2 or 3 story high, even higher than the children did down. And that temple felt really serene, just the altar and the shrine. Really nice feeling. Then my friend, who knows me quite well, said, see,
size that matters when it comes to Buddha statue. Yeah. The Swiss make Manjushri statue very impressive. And then you stand there, you really feel a bit different, you know, than this. I don't know whether it's my imagination, but it does feel very serene. Yeah.
So that is one way, one image of the Buddha that you relate to strongly, that you have a strong affinity towards. And this visualization, the Buddha statue, the Buddha image we bring to mind, represents the three jewels of Buddha, the teaching, the Dharma, and the community, the Sangha. And as usual, remember, then we are going to visualize light coming from the Buddha, entering to us. A shower of light and some positive energy flowing into you. And as we allow that energy to flow into our whole body, into our mind, into every cell of our body, we're going to chant the Buddha's mantra that we will tune. Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Soha. So that Shakyamuni Buddha's Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Soha. And that's the visualization. And in so doing, by reciting the mantra, visualizing, is one way that we practice reliance. We rely on Buddha in a more visual way, and we imagine the blessing, the inspiration of the Buddha flow from him into us. And he activates our inner potential, he activates our positive quality. So this is one way that, this is a simplified visualization. Quite a lot of people that I know engage in practice like this in times of difficulties or illness, very visual way of going for refuge. Sounds all right? Now, don't worry if you're like me. Nothing appears. No Buddha appears. No light appears. Nothing. No, just blank. That's also okay. So, don't have to struggle to see a clear image. In fact, it's best not to. Just don't be relaxed and just tell yourself that the Buddha is in front of me, even though I can't see him. That something really positive comes from him into yourself. So even though at the beginning maybe nothing appears. So some of us are very visual. Some people, visual images come to them very easily. Others are like me, a bit retarded in that area. No matter how hard I try, in fact, it gets worse if I try. They don't appear. And the best way to deal with that is to not struggle, just to relax. So almost like just trust. You trust that when times are right, something will appear. It may not be the one you have in mind, but sometimes it's not necessarily a visual image, maybe a feeling, a sensation. And that is also wonderful. Okay? And then as we do the visualization, we will return to my trust. Okay? So let's do a short meditation. So sit comfortably in a meditation posture that is more supportive to your body. Make sure that your back and spine is comfortable in an upright position. And rest your hands, your knees, or your back, in whichever way that allows your shoulders to be relaxed. Feel free to close your eyes completely if you want to. Some of you may prefer to visit. Them open a little, make them completely open, direct your gaze downwards to the floor in front of you, so whichever way works for you. And give your body a few moments to settle into this posture. And as much as possible, see if you can allow your body to relax, to release any unnecessary tension, tightness, especially those in the face. Very often people unconsciously tense up the facial muscles, especially when you ask them to visualize. See if you can relax the muscles in your face, relax the muscles in your Open up the whole face to feel softer, more comfortable, more relaxed. So visualization really doesn't involve any tensing of the muscles. You need to tense up the facial muscles. And just do your best. You can just imagine or just tell yourself the face in front of you, the level of your forehead, somewhere in front of about 2 meters away from you. In that space, see if you can allow an image of the Buddha to appear. Not to worry if nothing appears or if it appears, but it's unclear, it's always changing, shifting. That's perfectly fine. Just tell yourself, the space in front of you, there is the Buddha. Buddha appears in front of you, all his glory, his role, maybe sitting on the lotus seat. The Buddha is looking at you with compassion, with loving kindness. I think that this Buddha image embodies all three of that Buddha image, the Buddha Jewel, the Dharma Jewel, the Sangha Jewel. If you can, see if you allow the image to be alive. This is a living Buddha, not just a statue, not just an image. It actually represents a living Buddha, an enlightened one. Imagine from the heart of the Buddha in front of you, something really positive flows out from the Buddha, down through your crown, into your body, into your mind, filling up your body, your mind with positive energy, with life, with nectar. Often we, if you can, we imagine it in the form of golden yellow, color of harvest, of richness, of generosity. I think that this represents the blessing, inspiration, comes into you into our body and mind to inspire us, to activate our positive potential. So do your best to come back to this visualization throughout the practice as much as you can. And I'm going to chant the mantra of the Buddha. And feel free to join if you know the right tool. So you can just sit and listen to the reverberation of the mantra around you and to continue with visualization. Aya Tamo Buni Buni Maha Buniye Soha Aya Tamo Buni Continue with the visualization for a few more minutes. Just allow yourself to imagine the radiant yellow line and the positive energy flow from the Buddha in front of you, through your crown, into your own body. Just allow it to spread throughout your whole body, throughout your mind. Imagine it filling up every cell in your body. As much as possible, if you can imagine that your entire body is filled with golden line, every cell, every organ, tissue in your body, somehow touched by that line. Every part of the body is filled with this positive energy, this radiant yellow light. Then imagine that this light and matter really inspire you, really activate all the positive potentials within ourselves, how to reinforce our good qualities, how to help to encourage them to grow, to increase, to flourish within ourselves. Then we conclude with a simple dedication to dedicate all the positive momentum that you have created through your study and practice the Dharma and this practice. Dedicate them to the fulfillment of your own aspirations, your positive aspirations for yourself or for others. Dedicate this positive energy that you will be free from suffering, from the suffering, you will be able to create positive happiness, to be able to enjoy happiness. So that is a very simplified visualization. One of the very common way in Tibetan Buddhist tradition that we practice visualization combination with usually some prayer, mantra, and it's one way that we visualize how we can go for refuge to the Buddha Dhamma and Sangha, how we receive the blessing from the object of our refuge. Previously, I mentioned that I did this preliminary practice of 100,000 repetitions of the refuge formula. And so within that practice, Buddhist kind of similar kind of visualization. My recite refuge formula 100,000 times. When I tell the mantra, I recite for refuge to the Guru, for refuge to Buddha, for refuge to Dhamma, for refuge to Panda. Mostly, Buddha, Dhamma. Okay. Then you do that 100,000 times. Not in one session. Something similar. This is a very common way, very common visualization we do as a practice of learning to rely on the object. Any questions? Yes? So the question is, it seems that the outer refuge will come first before, we will find the outer refuge first before we find our inner refuge. Yeah, I suppose, no, usually, but not necessary. Yeah. Normally, conventionally, yes, we think so. No, first we must encounter the Buddha's teaching, maybe the spiritual teacher, or encounter the Buddhist community, learn about it, then we gain some realizations, and then we come find our so-called inner refuge. But life is always, reality is stranger than fiction. And some people actually have a realization first, before they know anything about Buddhism, and then many years later they encounter the teaching and say, oh, that was what it was all about. That is also, more rare, but not impossible. Because, especially, Buddhism, we believe in multiple lives, right? So, in one life, you may have a realization, previous life, and then so, in this current life, some people, they're not so much they newly realize, but they sort of remember. And sometimes that happens outside of a Buddhist context. It's only later they encounter Buddhism as a religion, as a context. So, as I said, usually, yes, the outer refuge comes first before the inner refuge. No, not necessarily. Oh, is it really necessary to have, another way of talking about it, do we really need all three, Can we do with one, just drop one nut, put a jewel, a bit, or the Sangha jewel, a little bit troublesome, so we forget about it. I think what happened is that, although conventionally it looks like there are three, right, we count the three, but in reality, the three are not really three separate things. It's not like we have to choose and say, can I have two instead of three? You know what I mean? I think what happens is the better way to think of it is start with one. Usually, as I mentioned previously and today, usually we are drawn to Buddhism via one of them. Could be a spiritual teacher, which we can see as the Buddha, as a representative of Buddha if we want, or we are drawn to the Dharma, the teaching, or we are drawn to the community, the people we met that may have supported us. So we are drawn to one. So we can start with one. And then later on, you may come to understand why they are actually three. They are not really, of course we count the three, but in the scheme of things, as we go deeper, the three are in a way, separate from one another. There is no Dharma without the Buddha or the Sangha. There is no Sangha without the Buddha and the Dharma. And there's really no Buddha without the Dharma. So in some way, later on we might see the interaction of the three not so separate. And it's not a matter of choosing or preference, but that they kind of tag along. So why not just, I actually think that why not just start with one, and then as our understanding deepens, we can start to see this one, the relationship of this object of refuge with other objects of refuge, become clearer to us. Alright, so that is for refuge. Next week, we'll talk about karma. So this whole topic is about protection. So we talk about protection from suffering from the point of view of refuge. And next week, we talk about protection from suffering from the point of view of our own action, karma. So we'll deal with that. So thank you very much for your attention. Have a good week, and I'll see you next week.